components of the scriptures. In 1978, they published the Chicago Statement on Biblical Inerrancy. Has anyone ever read that? It'd be worth your while. It's very good. In fact, I've got it in the notes, at least the shorter, briefer statement. That was followed in 1982 with a statement on hermeneutics. In other words, how do we interpret the Bible? And they finished in 1986 with a statement on application. I mean, doesn't that get to the heart of it? So it's one thing to say it's inerrant. It's another thing to say, well, so what does that mean? How do we interpret the Bible then? And not just how to interpret it, but if it doesn't impact our lives, something's profoundly wrong. And they were wise in that it was a 10-year life, so it went from 76 to 86. And when they finished that final document, the statement on application, they disbanded. So they didn't sense a need to perpetuate themselves, which is a good thing. And it's not as if they were now definitive, never having to be done again. Not at all. But here's the thing. That was done when they're in the midst of more of a, what we would say, a modernist mindset. I don't have the time to go in to talk about differences between modern and postmodern. All to say this, that postmodernism, as you know, denies absolute truth. Things are relative. That's the day in which we live now that wasn't there when they worked on the statement on inerrancy the first time. And you need to know now that there are huge issues that are being raised regarding the scriptures all over again. And it's an issue that we need to be aware of and know because it's the scriptures are being undermined in new ways. And here's the thing, the reason why we need to know some of these things, because we can't give 50-year-old answers. We can't give 1950 answers to 2009 questions. It's a different context. I'm not saying the truth in 1950 is no longer truth. I'm not saying that. I am saying that it's a different context, and it's asked with a different framework. And it's asked with a different spirit. And so we need to understand what that is so that we can respond to it rightly. The Bible is one of them. And I would say that these issues have led to these challenges. Number one, the postmodern shift in epistemology has led some evangelicals to question propositional revelation. In other words, they have... By the way, this is the first point of Greg Beale's book on inerrancy. Is it still out there? It's all gone. Beale's is one of the first responses to this sort of broader thinking on inerrancy. That's his first point. In essence, what it means is that people are taken with the story. But often it's the story at the expense of propositional truth. Certainly, God has revealed himself in story. It's his story, right? But he does so through propositional statements, doesn't he? And in fact, I think N.T. Wright is right when he said the strength of modernism was its commitment to truth. But its weakness was it was at the expense of the story. So you can figure out the truth, but you didn't have a clue where it fit in the story. The strength of postmodernism is the story. The weakness of postmodernism is it's at the expense of truth. I think that's right. I think that's a very, not simplistic, but I think a simple way of understanding some of the major differences. Number two, a significant number of conservative students have and are graduating with doctorates in biblical studies and theology from non-evangelical institutions. Now, does that need to fear us? No, or frighten us? No, it shouldn't frighten us. But in many ways, it's kind of a reversal of what happened in the 1940s with Ken Conser and Carl Henry and Harold Ockingay and others who were launching out in what is now known as evangelicalism, which was different from fundamentalism. All right? Fundamentalism and evangelicals embrace the same fundamental truths of the faith. All right? Understand that. They're one for one there. But fundamentalists were anti-education, anti-intellectual, and I don't use that with pejorative overtones, moral at all. They were opposed to that. In fact, in many cases, they were suspicious of any education. And generally, they were separatist in that they didn't want to engage in culture because it would infect them. Whereas the evangelical of 1940 of Ken Conser and Carl Henry and others, they said, no, if all truth is God's truth, well, then we need to be educated at the best of schools and engage these liberal scholars at the depth that they are teaching and believing and by God's grace convince them with the truth of God's word. And beyond that, we need to engage our society, our culture, with the hope that the gospel will transform lives. So you see a little difference there. But now what we have is some students, and again, the second point comes from Beale as well. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that one will end up with a suspicious view of Scripture, but that's the point that he's making. He's making an observation, all right? Third, relevance and respectability in the guild is often desired more than faithfulness. Now, I'm not saying for a moment that they're trying to be unfaithful, but once you get into the guild, there are huge temptations for that accompany that. That's true for all of us. It's kind of like what I cautioned us against earlier, that we're not professionals. We're servants. We're slaves. And joyful at that of Jesus Christ. And so one needs to be very careful and check one's motives about the relevance and respectability over against faithfulness. Yes, Stu.
On number two there,
he would talk about doctoral students.
It's a loaded question because it goes back to the point of...
Peter? Yeah.
We need to embrace a teaching environment in a way perhaps we haven't.
Yeah. That's not who he's addressing here, by the way. But there are formal and there are non-formal means. And I do think that we as, you know, what I've said, local churches can't do everything as far as the equipping, the preparing, and that sort of thing. But it does need to be a primary place where it happens. Not the exclusive. But it's at least the place where it begins. And if you as a pastor are not doing that, then you need to rethink part of the reason God has you there, Ephesians 4. And recognizing, yes, that there are limitations, and there are other places where, through the web or whatever, that can be extremely helpful, beneficial. One of the downsides to merely the individual web-based learning is it's not done in community. And that's where, you know, some of what we're trying to do through Gateway. Has anyone heard of Gateway? It's a ministry that we are attempting to do with our Hispanic brothers and sisters. You know, many of them coming in, they don't have a college degree, so they couldn't get to seminary even if they wanted to. Secondly, they're in situations where they don't have the money to do it. And they're already pastoring 2 and 3 churches. How can they leave to do that? And so we have created Gateway, which is a ministry of a theological education that meets on a monthly basis with an instructor and maybe 5 to 10 to 12 students. And every month they meet, they've written a paper regarding an article of our statement of faith. The thing I like about that, more so than just the individual, is that theology is done in the context of community. And I think it's a healthy thing. So we are aware of that, and we also are using, you heard of TUMI? The Urban Ministry Institute? You know, we're using some of that as well. So I hear what you're saying, But Greg Beal is dealing with doctoral students. So those that have come through, they've got a master's degree or an MDiv or whatever, and they're going on for PhD work. That's the student that he's addressing. Fourth, the notion, this is parallelomania. That's an interesting word. There was an article written by that by Barry Beitzel in Trinity Journal. You remember that one, Matt?
I've seen it.
Okay, thank you. Is used when doing background study, and if a similar account is found in some other ancient Near Eastern document, it flattens and possibly even negates the supernatural nature of the word. That is happening, by the way. That is happening. It's some of what you will, if you read Greg Beal's book on inerrancy, that's part of what's happening. In other words, he's responding to Peter Enns, who used to teach at Westminster Theological Seminary. Used to is important. His book on inspiration and incarnation, where he spells out some of this, and this is a tendency of the whole. You know, you look around and you see other things that are there and with ancient Near Eastern history, and you see a parallel, and then that must mean that can't be true, or it negates the supernatural, or whatever the case might be. Well, it's just a reality, and it's happening. Kenton Sparks is another one. I've got his bibliography on the end slide. Fifth, modernism's strength was an emphasis on truth. Its weakness was that it came at the expense of God's overarching story. This is what I shared with you. Postmodernism's strength is an emphasis on story. Its weakness is that it comes at the expense of truth. Number six, there is a healthy focus on the church doing theology. This is good. But the problem is that it is often theology that is tangentially related to the Bible. It's another issue that I think has become a problem. The reason I say that is it's theology, and it's an emphasis back now on theology, but what is theology, systematic theology, what is it rooted in? Biblical theology, thank you. And what's biblical theology rooted in? Exegesis. And often what you're finding with those that are doing the theologizing, and there are new commentary series on the theologizing, there is a new periodical on this very issue that Joel Green is editing, and the problem is, I'm not so sure that they're as carefully and as committed to the exegesis and the biblical theology that will serve the foundation for systematic theology. I do agree that the church needs to regain a commitment to doing theology. I agree with that. But what I'm saying is, I think it's having an effect on the Bible. So, we can end up with liberation theology, we can end up with eco-green theology, we can end up with feminist theology, we can end up with etc. You see where that goes? And can one finally say, does it say nothing? Does it say everything? Back first, and then up here. Would agree with what statement?
Modernism strength was an emphasis on truth.
They would agree with that?
No, they wouldn't. They wouldn't.
Sure, they would. You don't think fundamentalists think they can't get to truth? Remember the fundamentalist understanding of essentials?
Yeah.
How many things were in that essential category? Not very many? Wait a minute. Virtually everything. No. Modernism goes back to the Enlightenment. Rationalism. Empiricism. No. But it can be discovered. That's the issue. Truth can be discovered. That's the issue. Yeah. Up here first. Ancient Near Eastern history. The floods of Noah. In fact, here's an interesting, very interesting thing. Creation accounts. And it's primarily Genesis 1 to 11 is where you're going to find a lot of these issues arise. Someone from the Evangelical Free Church in Northfield, she was excited to tell me about this incident. She was at her dentist, and her dentist said, "Hey, you're gonna find this fascinating. You know, I just saw on the History Channel or something like that. I just saw that. You know what? There are other accounts of a flood of a you know, deluge of water that are out there, which indicates that, you know, Noah's flood never even really happened. Well, in essence, it takes it out of the supernatural. It can, but it doesn't. It doesn't for them. And what I'm saying is that's why it flattens it. So if you can find a parallel someplace else, then that trumps any supernatural component. And it also indicates that it's really almost not irrelevant, but it's like every other myth. See, that at the end of the day, that's what it is. It validates it's merely a myth.
You're familiar with John Wooden?
Oh, yes, Wheaton.
Yeah. He wants to hold the biblical framework, but he wants to recognize the similarities rather than misapply the text because of us putting our own context on it. So it doesn't go to the extreme as
Peter Enns?
But he's trying to find that balance because what has happened, he believes anyway, in evangelical scholarship is the whole freeing your biases on Old Testament, where it's just turned into this teaching on character and morality and forgetting about what's actually going on.
And I would agree with that.
That's going to the other extreme.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. Now, what I find interesting is, so does Dr. Walton not have biases?
No, he does.
Right, okay. See, this is something that I think the postmodernism has helped us with. That is, you know, everybody thought that there was this wonderful neutral position from which we could approach that. This is modernism now. We could approach it and we could get to truth myself. Whereas postmodernism has said, now wait a minute, we all have biases. It doesn't necessarily negate the fact that there's truth, but let's acknowledge our presuppositions. Let's acknowledge our biases. It doesn't mean that we can't come to a conclusion, but there are, certainly we approach, remember what I talked about yesterday in that diagram? It talked about theological presuppositions. We all approach the text that way. But if we're unwilling to have the text refine them and reform them, then we've got a problem. So I would agree. My concern, for example, with Peter Enns, Kent, and Sparks, is that now they've gone too far the other way. So I do think that there was some truth in that. I mean, right, exactly, and you just can't do that. Was there someone else? Okay. Oh, 10:15. Matt, you want to dismiss us for a break?
14 minutes.
Okay, great. 14 minutes.